Welcome to the Corporate Treasury 101 podcast. In today's episode, we discuss how the role of the treasurer has evolved, COP and SS1/21, with Kevin Grant from Bottom Line. Kevin was named one of the 100 most influential people in finance by Treasury and Risk magazine. And with an impressive 30 years of experience in financial technology, Kevin is the chief revenue officer for Bottom Line's corporate product line covering payments and treasury management. Bottom Line is all about transforming business payments and processes for companies and financial institutions around the world. The company helps hundreds of thousands of customers globally to automate and simplify their business payments. In this episode, expect to learn, how has the relationship between CFOs and treasurers evolved in recent years? The impact of COP on treasurers and how should they prepare for it and adapt? How does SS2/21 impact third-party risk management? And what are the key core considerations for treasurers in this context? What strategies or best practices should companies adopt to effectively manage risk associated with outsourcing and third-party engagement, and much, much more. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If that's the case, when you're thinking about how you found a podcast, chances are it was through word of mouth, social media, or recommendations from your favorite podcast platform. And those recommendations come from reviews. So it'd be great if you could go and please make sure you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening to the show. It really, really helps, and it's going to help us grow the world of treasury. So with that, please welcome Kevin. Kevin, welcome on the CT 101 podcast. Great to have you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Amazing. So we're going to go over some really interesting stuff today for treasurers. We're going to go over the relationship between the CFO, the treasurer, how that's evolved, COP and SS1/21, which I'm interested to find out what that means because we love breaking down acronyms and little standards and notations like that. So let's start off with you've seen a lot of years of payments, right? And finance in general. And I'd love to hear a little bit about that. But you've seen in our pre-call, really the evolution of treasury as a function and specifically like the CFOs and treasurers and how that relationship has evolved over time, just through your sheer seniority in the industry, if I may say. So how, in your experience and from your perspective, has the relationship between CFOs and treasurers evolved in recent years?
So thank you for asking that question. I think senior years, grey beard kind of tells you that I've been around for some time. And actually, surprisingly, I do see a contradiction between what treasury was defined as and its role was in the 1990s and what the definition would be today. And just to bring this old hawk up to date, I did have a look at some of the chatbots and what they might, how they define finance and treasury. And what was very interesting for me was that in the 90s, treasury was a macro function. Treasury sat above and separate from the financial operations in a business. And you quite often hear commentary around, well, we look after macro risk around cash availability in the business and securing cash for the business. But they weren't really talking about mainstream accounts receivable. They were talking about capital markets. They were talking about relationships with banks and raising finance. And they were talking about looking forward 6 months, 12 months, 5 years, 10 years, and in some cases, 30 years, putting finance in place. If you work in the aerospace sector, then the length of products and the time to revenue are recognized in decades, which is surprising. Today is defined quite differently in that treasury is now part of the mainstream finance operations, has responsibility for in areas of receivables, payables, working capital management is a wider definition. So what the definitions tell us, and my experience resonates with that, is that treasury is now part of the mainstream finance function rather than separate from it. And that means that they are consuming larger volumes of data and they want the consumption of that to be as real time as possible. And that is driving decision making on cash management on a daily basis. So it's turned out that it seems to be a bit of a shorter term focus of the treasury function. And if you look at the wider finance function, that's defined as one that looks after budgets, planning, longer term strategic objectives of the organization. So for me, that feels a little bit like a 360. So, just to finish off, and particularly to your point around the CFO, really that comes down to a decision about size of organization. If you go to large enterprise, now how do we define that? Let's just take an arbitrary number of organizations of $20 billion turnover and higher. You kind of find that the treasurer may have a seat on the board alongside the CFO. It's seen as a separate function within the organization. And in other organizations, medium to smaller, you'll find that treasurers will report into a CFO or a VP of finance. So I think they're both intrinsically linked, and I think in today's world that link is better understood, and the value that both roles play within the organization is more clearly defined.
So Kevin, what do you think have been the factors that have driven these changes? So you described quite well how treasury's moved more mainstream, but like, do you see that having come about from just the complexity of financial and treasury operations, or has that been a natural evolution of just the industries? Why has that happened?
So I think just as a backdrop here, there are two phrases I've heard throughout my career. One from the customer environment, from the finance and treasury functions, where it's quite often stated, we're a simple, plain vanilla treasury department. Nothing special going on here. And the other one from the supplier side is that there is no two treasury operations that have the same need, even from the same industry vertical. So both of them, in their own ways, are statements that can be justified. And why is it then that Treasury can make the statement that they're just a simple vanilla Treasury department? And that because that, and down to the, and really, so the example that I would give to that is that, I've worked with $200 billion turnover organizations where the Treasury function is really simple, because that's driven by board policy, and that's driven by the fact that they don't want to be engaging in complex derivatives or complex financing structures, and their main focus in the business is around working capital. So what they really want to do is have efficient finance processes, which ensures we collect what's money's owed to us through accounts receivable quickly, as quickly as possible, that we manage dunning processes and credit management if there's default on the payers side. And on the payment side, let's make sure that we pay on time within their contractual obligations and ensure that we maintain those supplier relationships that are important to our supply chain. On the other flip side, I can talk to small enterprise, $300 million, $500 million turnover, let's call it, who have, let's blame the Internet of Things for this because, let's use the word blame, why not, right? But the Internet of Things means that we can have outreach to diversified customers in different countries. And I've worked with organizations who have such a setup. Therefore, they are consuming lots of foreign currency through the sale of their goods, and therefore they have a complex foreign exchange risk management process that's in place. And that's very important to them. So I think one size doesn't fit all, but size is not a definition of complexity of treasury need. So coming back to your first question is what's driven this? I think we as a treasury function, we're driven by regulation, external regulation around what we were doing in the early stages of the millennium. There was International Accounting Standards, IFRS 9, I think, IFRS 9 is the standard, as I recall it. And that was actually saying to organizations that you had to take what was termed as in accounting as off-balance sheet derivative transactions and actually try to map those to market so that there could be an understanding of the risks associated with those instruments. And you had to take that through your P&L, so therefore it affected your financial KPIs and allowed external third parties to have a better insight as to the operational risk. Let's imagine you had invested in the stock of a tobacco company. What was the operational risks being implied by the off-balance sheet treasury derivative transactions that they have in place? And those treasury derivatives had leverage and therefore could undermine the whole financial viability of the stock that you were investing in. So that was a drive for more detailed understanding and more open and transparent accounting standards. That in itself then drove a need for sophistication of need within Treasury. There's a lot of, hedge accounting sounds simple, but there's a lot of Monte Carlo simulation in there. You need computing power to process those things. It wasn't something that you could model in a spreadsheet yourself. And then we started to think, okay, this complexity is quite interesting. Let's dive into risk management a little bit more deeper, which is truly a treasury function, quite separate from a cash management or finance function. But risk management then started to look at correlations between different financial derivatives in different markets, in different countries, in different exchanges, and actually tell us that, you know, what is the, I would like to view it as systemic risk between derivative transactions that kind of seem to be in isolation from each other and have different purposes. But what did all that complexity tell us or help us with when we had financial crisis? Not a lot, to be honest. We didn't predict it. The models didn't foresee it. And in fact, what I experienced through working with some of my corporate customers, those who had a hold of the basics, were looking at bank counterparties, understanding the credit ratings of those bank counterparties, looking at the credit default swaps, which basically is insurance one financial institution buys against the settlement default risk of another counterparty, were increasing against a particular bank. And they actually withdrew their funds and moved them to what they determined to be a safer bank before that bank collapsed, yeah? And I think that's a key tipping point for me, is that in my life, until the financial crisis happened in this industry, that you were always asked to benchmark an investment outside of the bank account. And the bank account was always seen as a risk-free rate of return on surplus cash. People didn't believe banks would fail. And since that banking crisis, there's been a realization, a Yahoo moment, and people have been saying, okay, let's have a policy that defines what we're doing. Let's make sure we understand it at board level without complex mathematics, and let's sure that we've got treasury activity, use of treasury derivatives, and let's not forget, even a simple FX spot transaction is a derivative. It's a contract today for settlement in 2 days' time, that we understand those, confirm which of those instruments we want the organization to use, and ensure that they are liquid, i.e. if we encounter a systemic crisis within the financial markets in the future, we can close out our positions. Because many people were holding complex, illiquid, exotic derivatives and found that they couldn't close out their losing hand, if I can put it in those terms.
So what I take from that is that you're saying the evolution of these, like, the evolution of the role of the Treasury Department has largely come about due to, I think you mentioned two factors there. One is that our understanding of financial risk has changed quite a lot, especially around the whole bank failures thing, right? So 2007, 2008 onwards, your financial risk models just look very differently because banks are now a financial risk as opposed to just a completely safe thing. I mean, I guess now the equivalent is just bonds. That's the only thing that you can say is safe. And then everyone's probably getting a little bit cheap about those as well, which nowadays, though, like, fixed assets are quite interesting in terms of interest rates, right?
Yep.
And then the other thing you said there, and I want you to dive in and give and correct me or add more nuance, is that financial products have also just gotten more complex over time. And as more complex financial products are coming into the market, and these are becoming options, not only for you to implement in your treasury, but also if you have any corporate bonds or you have any investments in any other companies in any form or state, they might have these complex financial products, derivatives, which could be highly leveraged, which again completely changes your financial risk model, or could even be just something that you don't quite understand because it's just so exotic, because they piece together and all these different things that and package them up as a subprime mortgage example is exactly that.
Yes.
Right? That's what we learned, was behind these seemingly good looking derivatives can be an underlying amount of pile of shit, to put it lightly, which you need, until you actually scratch behind the surface, you're not going to really find out. On the surface, it looks really good. And then you have to go dive down all these different things. And the treasury policies can really define how complex that interaction gets between the boardroom, the C-suite, the CFO, and the treasury department. Is that a good summary of
everything? Yeah, I think it's a good summary. And again, regulations drivenness. So, you know, Dodd-Frank, I will have a look at the legislation, but there was a US legislation brought out after the financial crisis to say that ignorance at board level was no longer acceptable. Ignorance of the financial derivatives, that is no longer acceptable. Board individuals will be held personally accountable for any inappropriate use of derivative transactions. And I think there was also an element of ignorance, if I can say so, in the consumption on the corporate side. they would be offered certain financial products by investment banks or to help them with managing of risk. Larger, well-capitalized companies are the ones that the banks would be willing to take, offer credit lines to, and offer facilities to. Yeah, Basel I, Basel II have forced banks to look at their own capital adequacy requirements, which means they've got to look at who we're offering credit to and what's the risk of that credit. That then has driven mainstream banks to actually de-risk their corporate relationships to an extent, and they're offering credit facilities to organizations who are well capitalized and don't really need that credit. So banks have been scratching around looking for other revenue streams. Beneath mainstream banks, then you have the growth of payment service provider organizations who are regulated under FCA, but they are willing to extend credit to medium to small enterprise organizations to try and assist them with their risk management. So in some ways that's positive. In other ways, you've got to make sure that there's a strong corporate governance around ensuring there's no mis-selling. So PSPs have got an obligation to make sure the corporate who's using the financial instrument to manage risk has an understanding of the risks or the risks and benefits that the use of those instruments present. Because risk management is a two-sided coin. If you actually have a position which said, okay, I need to consume dollars, I'm going to hold dollars, but then you find dollars that you're holding devalue against sterling, which happens to be the consumption currency at some point in the future, you'll find yourself in a position where the dollars you bought today are worth less in sterling in the future. Yeah. And therefore, it doesn't really matter if the dollar, let me think of this way around, if the dollar sales of that particular product are also being substantiated by the foreign exchange market movements, right? So might not be explaining that particularly well, but the point is that position that you take from a financial instrument is a position, and it can be in the money or out of the money in the future. It may have proven to be having been a good decision, or it may have proven to be a bad decision, but it doesn't matter. If you're saying, I'm going to receive this amount of dollars in the future, and I'm going to do a foreign exchange now that says, okay, I can exchange those at $2 to the pound in 6 months' time. But when I get to that point in the future, the market has moved against me, and it's $1.50 to every pound. As long as the underlying commercial activity of the business is being hedged, who cares, right? You've done your job. You shouldn't value the financial instruments, gain or loss, profit or non-profit, in the terms of its standalone instrument. You should view it in terms of the underlying business risk that it's looking to manage. And there's
Indeed,
lots of
that's probably
examples of
something
this.
that.
And sorry, go on. See that.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say that's probably what the treasurer's main role is with the CFO, right? In today's environment, is like how far do you think? Well, maybe pose that as a question. How far do you think that's the role of the treasurer to understand that underlying risk versus other people inside the office of the CFO? Is that the treasurer's responsibility?
So I think it's so let me just try and maybe just ring fence things a little bit in terms of how we see things. I mean, as I've said earlier on, the Treasury is part of the finance function, but they do have, they're looking to they do focus in different areas, right? So finance is looking more at longer term strategic investments. Now, as part of that, if you are going to, build a manufacturing center in India, for example, you will have to have Indian rupees as a consumption cash in that to pay for that infrastructure build in India. But you may not have any customers in India, and your main income stream comes from a dollar customer base. So implicit in that strategic investment means that you have to be selling dollars at some point to Indian rupees to actually meet the consumption needs of your business in rupees at some point in the future. So there's a link there. You would want the treasury function to be supporting finance and being aware of the strategic need to the business and making sure that the currency denomination and the currency amounts are available at the right time for the consumption needs of the business. Likewise, if it's a longer term investment, treasury would be working closely with finance to put in place a funding mechanism. You mentioned bonds earlier. They could issue bonds. They may go to, banks. They may go to syndicate of banks and ask for a loan facility. And all of that sounds very simple, but when you start to think about the ability to borrow in one currency and use financial instruments to actually create a virtual relationship between that and the Indian rupee currency you want to consume through FX swaps, interest rate swaps, that's when it starts to become complicated. That's where you need the treasury expertise and risk management around treasury to help you manage those longer term macro level risks. However, more and more cash management is where treasury is being asked to focus, because that longer term piece, once it's in place, you have a system that allows you to manage your obligations in terms of repayment, interest rate fixings, interest rate prepayments. It's just a diary of events, right? But it's a diary of events with future cash flows that you want to be able to understand, visualize, and make part of your working capital management responsibilities. And that's where treasury has taken more of a hands-on role in the main financial operations around working capital management. And that's more of a focused on the day-to-day management of the company's financial resources. And what is working capital management, right? Working capital management is about managing current assets and current liabilities. And if we dig down into that a little bit further, what does that mean? It's cash in bank, cash in hand, right? What do we have? Of all of the bank accounts across the world, where do we have bank accounts? What's the value of the funds in those bank accounts, and what's the currency of the funds in those bank accounts? And then we have accounts receivable, then we have accounts payable, then we have stock, we have inventory. And we're looking at, okay, how do we manage that in a working capital management environment to basically keep the lights on in the company? How do we make sure that we've got the money to pay for payroll? How do we make sure that we've got the ability to pay for short-term loan obligations, expenses, our own accounts payable obligations to suppliers, ad hoc things like tax payments, dividend payments? So treasury is in the mainstream of that now, and my contention is that treasury risk management is separate from cash management. However, cash management is part of working capital management, which falls under the responsibility of treasury if you look at today's definition. So hopefully that's helpful just as background. And to my earlier points, industry vertical, turnover of business is no definition of the complexity of the need of the buyer or the corporate. It's all down to their own capital structure, and it's all down to their own permitted use of derivative transactions as defined by their treasury policy.
Which it comes back again, right? It comes back to the treasury policy. So your treasury operation is as complex as you want it to be, right? You either take the cost of potential missed opportunities from not having these derivatives in your foreign exchange risk and your interest rate risk in your or the opportunity cost of capitalizing on your cash savings, right? Or your cash accounts versus the headache and or the availability of working capital, I guess, right?
Yeah, and quite often, if you're protecting the budget, yeah, if you're putting, because the world is multi-currency, there's multi-currency in the supply chain, there's multi-currency in the consumption of your products and services, it becomes complex, right? But it's only complex because of the volume of data and the need for clean data on a fast, real-time basis to help you drive decision making intraday. That's where technology can really help. And I think that's where I can draw a line in my own mind between a treasury management system and a cash management system. And it really just comes down to the definitions that we have currently in the marketplace. If you think about risk management as being a treasury function, treasury management system will help you with your complex hedge accounting. It will help you with the management of your complex instruments. And let's not forget, there can be complexity of portfolio of instruments that are set up to satisfy a specific need. That's separate from a cash management solution. The cash management solution is looking at your daily opening balances, projected closing balances. It's looking at your accounts receivable information from ERP or ERPs. It's looking at your accounts payable obligations, ERPs in many worlds, and actually giving you an understanding of whether you're long cash or short cash, simply put, and which currencies are your long cash and short cash. And then it's the treasurer's or treasury function responsibility to go externally and move money around, engaging in short-term FX derivative transactions, FX spots forwards, or to use available currency amounts within the business to support that foreign currency need without having to transact in external markets. And also when it comes, there's a big focus on in treasury having responsibility for the payment process, because you can control what you pay. It's difficult to control what you receive, but you can control what you pay, absolutely. And there's a big focus on minimizing fraud by ensuring that you have a visibility for one, defined processes for another, qualified people, and ensuring that the release channels, the bank channels, the payment rails that you're using are secure.
Super interesting. And that leads us a little bit nicely, I think, into our next topic, which we want to capitalize on the expertise that you have, Kevin, and also what Bottomline brings as well. So take us through what confirmation of payee, COP, is and its significance in the financial world.
So as part of Pay UK, and there's a new feature, facility, process that's been made available. It's driven by open banking, basically. But it's the ability to, if you're making a payment to Kevin Grant, that you can check that Kevin Grant is an individual or a business. You can check the address of that individual or business. You can check the sort code and bank account are valid. And these are real-time checks. And I think open banking has driven this, and that's a great technology and regulatory change that is really driving security around payout processes. The other piece that's just as exciting is the confirmation of payer. So if we think about consumer, B2C, consumer businesses, you and I have certainly signed up to direct debits, I'm sure, for products and services we wish to consume. At the point of setting up that direct debit mandate, that can be done electronically, digitally, doesn't need paper formats anymore, and it can be built into the third-party merchant acquirer technology via web forms. And not want to get into techno babble here, but effectively you could be using Bottomline's technology, consuming a third-party services, be it a telecommunications company or a digital television company or whatever, insurance company, as examples. But effectively, when I'm signing you up as a customer of mine, and you're going to pay me these funds, I can check that you exist as an individual, you've got an address in the UK, and you've got a sort code and a bank account that are verified by your bank. And therefore, I've got a high degree of confidence that when I bring you on board as a new customer, that the direct debit mandates are going to succeed. So it's a reduction of failure to collect upfront. And it's fraud prevention, right? There's a lot of push payment frauds in the industry at the moment. We've all got stories of family members, unfortunately, who, in a moment of stress or distraction, have not really paid attention to what they're being asked to do. And we all receive multiple emails every day of people pretending to be HMRC or the post office, some other delivery organization, effectively. They're just looking to encourage you to push money out to them from your bank account. And if you have valid COP checks, you can reduce the amount of fraudulent activity or be made aware of it before you actually release payments. So what you're looking to do is use payment infrastructure providers like Bottomline to actually put all of these checks in place to be your custodian, your guardian, your sentinel, however you want to phrase it, but basically having oversight to what's going on and actually telling you if there is something that doesn't look quite right, and you can then do something about it. Likewise, it's not just limited to domestic banks in the UK. We can provide, and other people can do this also, so it's not just us, but we can provide a quality of security around your non-banks payments, whether it's CHAPS or faster payments, or if you're then looking at overseas international payments through SWIFT networks, and we can protect you against making payments to sanctioned individuals or sanctioned companies, because we can understand the overseas IBAN number beneficiary. We can do lots of sense checking, and there's the sanction lists that are issued that we will adhere to and flag early before you do something that might put you in a controversial situation with your banking partners.
And how does that impact treasurers specifically? So I think I liked that you used a lot of individual examples, but like for a treasurer, for a corporate treasurer, How's that going to impact them, and what should they do to be prepared?
So I think if the corporate treasurer is, you know, responsible for the payment processes within a business, there are a couple of benefits here. Often, very often, actually over 90% of the organisations we talk to have more than one back-end ERP, regardless of how small you are. So, and therefore, not having one common ERP.
Does Excel count as a back-end ERP?
Excel can act as an analysis tool. I like it. I still use it every day myself when as an analysis tool. But to rely upon it as your core workflow control, I would say, is a massive risk. So you can consolidate information.
Yeah, it happens, right?
For analytics, great. Yeah, you're right. There's people out there now who are using it. And so the purpose of the benefit we're going to see here is that I like to think about, we really can take advantage of the cloud. I mean, I worked in the DOS worlds, and the cloud was internet was introduced in the mid-90s, right? And it promised all sorts of interaction of data. GDPR put a stop to a lot of that because you've got to have control, have limited use, and you've got to protect the consumer and businesses and all good stuff that's out there. But for a practical example for a treasurer, you would want to have visibility of all payments being made locally and globally. You would want to define one process which supports a policy. You'd want to have people who have got the right education and skill sets to use the technology. And that's the third part, right? You need technology to augment the people to support the process. So again, it's all starting from the policy. What are we allowed to do? Let's put a process in place that defines it, people with the right skill set, and let's not have loads of people doing things, because that in itself is a risk. Let's have technology that can automate things. Therefore, suppliers like ourselves can be seen as the hub of the wheel, with spokes into different back-end systems on a global basis. There's no restriction. And also to then pull that information in from different versions of SAP, ERP, or a more complex landscape where there's multiple ERPs, and actually remove the approval process from those local systems. Have the local people using the central web-based application, and you can then still allow them to follow a common process, still have them locally accountable for what they do, but they're following a common process using a common tool. You can observe what they're doing. That in itself is a huge asset in terms of managing the risk of internal fraud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds all like very positive benefits indeed. So this comes with open banking, right? So how does a treasurer kind of get access to this kind of like security, let's say? Does the treasurer themselves have to go off to a vendor like yourself and get that implemented? Or do you work with like banks and transaction service managers that implement this, and the treasury is just going to find a service provider that implements this kind of technology? How does like the treasurer actually get access to this?
Yeah, so there are two channels. Our technology is white labeled by banking partners and, you know, treasurers. I would like to widen it to finance function, but I think they're synonymous. But I think for the audience listening in, there's still a block in the minds that treasury isn't part of mainstream finance. This is something I find every day, not a frustration, but it's a repeat sort of statement from my side, is that treasury is part of mainstream finance operations. And I was pleased to see that Chatbot agrees with me, because when I asked it to define what treasury management was back in the 90s, it couldn't answer the question. But the reason I did that is to try to keep me fresh and relevant to the younger audience who may be on board here. But the current definition really does put it into that current assets, current liabilities, working capital management, which means it needs to talk to its banks, right? So you may have a banking partner who will say, we will give you more than just access to our bank accounts. We'll allow you to access other bank accounts through the SWIFT network so that you can pull bank statements from one system rather than having to log into multiple banking portals with the different security needs of those portals, and then to pull that information and consolidate it. You know, they can work directly with us, or they can work through our banking partner who may be using our technology. And just from, you know, governors and Chinese walls, we separate, you know, partner, channel and direct relationships. The point I think that I would like to emphasize is that there is a difference between cash management, global payment hub, and a treasury management system. And again, this is for a definition in the marketplace. A treasury management system has risk management capability. It has some cash management and payment capability, but it has risk management on top as well, right? Risk management is into the more complex area of derivative use. So if you're not into that complex use of derivatives and your main function is to manage working capital, again, we define that as accounts receivable, accounts payable, cash trapped in inventory, or goods on a shelf waiting to be sold, you can take a cash management solution from bottom line, which will allow you to facilitate all of that process requirement, automate many things for you, and will protect the funds that you're managing. It will allow for some short-term derivative use, simple derivative use, investing surplus cash, you know, borrowing short-term, doing some foreign exchange deals, spots and forwards. Those are really treasury derivatives that augment, supplement, and are part of today's definition of treasury management in terms of focusing on working capital management within the business. It doesn't take away from the fact that they work closely with finance, and if the finance are looking after longer term budgeting and planning and infrastructure and strategic objectives, that they won't still ask treasury to partner with them to help with that longer term risk management, capital capital structure they want to put in place to support those strategic objectives, and manage the, not risks, but manage the obligations under those structures that have been put in place. And if those structures are not plain vanilla and they have derivative elements to them, then there's complexity to them. And yes, of course, you need treasury to be involved in that, and you would need risk management tools that bottom line wouldn't supply to you, and you would get those from other providers of, let's say, most sophisticated treasury management systems who have their roots in the start of the millennium, is probably the best way of putting it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense indeed. Nice way to put it indeed. Kevin, bring us over to something that I've no clue what this is. So you're going to have to take with me really to like a 101 on this. So SS1/21, outsourcing and third-party risk management. Can you sort of elaborate on what that is exactly, and what does it do? What is it?
Yep. So this in itself is one of the reasons I love working in this field of treasury and finance. There's always change happening. It's either change through regulation, it's change through internal audit and policy formulation. Let's see if that word works. But through the formulation of a policy, you need to conduct an audit, right? So you understand what's going on and what treasury and finance are doing. So again, there can be internal audit, which drives policy change, which drives change in process, people and systems that are used within the finance function. And I had no clue about PRA either until about 3 months ago. So I'm learning as well. So I love the fact that there's always opportunities to expand knowledge and experience within this field. So to explain what it is, it's Payment Regulation Authority, so Bank of England, first published an operational resilience impact statement around March 2021, is where it has its origins, and they updated that advice in March 22. And you know, this was the sort of carrot, here's what you want me to do, and it's all around operational resilience, and it's at impact tolerances for important business services. Important business services is kind of limited to banks, financial institutions and insurance companies at this stage. And they have to prove by, I think it's March 2025, that they have basically put business continuity services in place, which is my sort of a simplified generic technology term of what they're trying to achieve here. And why are they doing this? Well, they're saying if you're in insurance, there are pensioners who expect a pension to be paid each month. If you're making those payments through UK payment rails, take backs for an example, what happens if you fail to make those pension payments because of a system failure? Or what happens if you fail to make those payments because there is a breakdown in the backs payments infrastructure in the UK? So it's about risk management. And there are ways of mitigating your risk through your existing backs provider failing. We have a very important role to play in that. As bottom line, we have got 55% of the bikes traffic flows through our infrastructure on an annual and daily basis. So if the provider fails, you need to have another means of accessing the bikes clearing system so that your bikes payments are cleared through and reach the beneficiary or the payee, if we want to call it that. If the bikes network is down itself, that's also a risk, right? So what happens if bikes isn't available? How would you notify your bank that you want to make these payments to those pensioners if your communication rails through bikes into those banks fails? That's when you have to look at host-to-host connectivity, right? And we have built resilience, different technology platform, different cloud infrastructure within our own service delivery, which would allow for bottom line to have its own business continuity if bikes failed, so we could still deliver and support our customers. So it's that's the genesis of this. It's Bank of England legislation, and they're trying to understand and mitigate risks of payment infrastructure failure or business service providers in the banking, insurance and finance institution sector.
Mm-hmm. So how does that directly impact the role of a treasurer then? So what's the practical changes that's going to come in for a treasurer as of this being implemented?
So I think they have to become more technically astute. I think they have to look beyond the payment workflow and approval process. I think they have to get more involved with technology and understand who are our technology providers. They have to start monitoring SLAs around uptime and availability of those service providers. And ultimately, they're going to have to spend money on that business continuity, because you'll either have to have more than one supplier. One is primary, one is secondary, assuming that the BACS infrastructure remains up. However, if BACS goes down, then you need to have a non-BACS backup secondary provider or tertiary provider, however they want to manage their own risk profiles, up to them, but someone who could then deliver BACS files into the bank via a host-to-host connectivity rather than using the BACS payment rails to do so. So it's going to cost money, but that money is going to help. It's an insurance policy, right? It's going to help you comply with regulation, and we all have to spend money to comply.
Well, that's the thing, right? So we get a lot of treasurers often complaining about the fact that, you know, they're not the first place that the budget goes, you know, inside the department. Now, if legislation is driving it, I guess it's a different story altogether. But do you have any advice for how to convince the budget release on these kind of things? Like, what's the business benefit other than, I guess you've got the safety net thing, right?
So ultimately, it's about credibility as a business provider. Reputational damage is the way we quite often refer to that. The way you framed the question, though, plays to what I commonly come across, in that Treasury is, I'll come back to my earlier statement, simple vanilla Treasury, under-resourced and over-challenged in terms of the operational support they have to put in place. Yeah, if you're a Treasury function that is still sitting outside the main finance operations, i.e. you don't have responsibility for accounts receivable and days sales outstanding, if you don't have a responsibility for DPO, days payments outstanding, if you don't have a responsibility for cash in hand, cash at the bank, if you don't have responsibility for working capital as a generic term, then you probably will struggle to justify the need. So coming back to my earlier definitions of it, I see treasury and cash management as complementary in some organizations. It's the same people who do both. And if you're the same people who are doing both, justifying that you will ensure that payments reach the destination and minimize reputational risk, if you can ensure that payments are going to be, will protect and have be watertight against fraudulent activity, internal or external players, if you can prove that it will stop the business breaching any of its regulatory sanctions, obligations. I have not encountered any customer of mine that can't get budget to support those digitization of financial processes. It's a hot topic, has been for a number of years, has been since 2013 when I kind of 2015, really, when I moved out of mainstream treasury management and got more involved in the accounts payable, accounts receivable, because it's important to have, if you're going to do that job efficiently, you need to have visibility of all bank accounts globally, and you need to have visibility of all accounts receivable, all accounts are payable within the next 30 to 120 days if you're going to do your job efficiently. That's what the corporation you work for wishes you to do, given the experience of the financial crisis, which has had a sobering effect on people's willingness to engage with complex derivatives and complex risk management.
Indeed. No, well, that's good because that's typically what we see as well, is that it's just more the framing of like presenting the correct business value of these investments typically, where treasurers maybe see it from their perspective. A lot of the time, the advice that we get from guests that come on the show for treasurers in these positions is really reframing it in a way that it's more important for the overall business, right? Reputational risk, like you said, automation of financial processes, reduction of overall risk internally. These kind of things are all factors that would be a much more convincing argument than just, hey, it's regulation, I need to
Yes.
do it.
Yes. And I think it also, as we've, we keep talking about COVID, but it was an inflection point in the way we transact. Very rare now that, we carry cash. Very rare that people even carry cards. I'm still berated and laughed at by my adult children that, I still carry a little bit of cash and all cards, and I still don't feel comfortable using my mobile phone to make payments. I will do, but that's me, right? And that's my wishes and needs as a consumer of tech. It's important, I think, that we don't try and sell things. We try and consult through the sales process, and we ask the customer first and foremost, what are your priorities within your digitization of finance, because that's a phrase that's very commonly understood. And if the conversation drives us to a bank account cash visibility problem, to a fragmented technology problem around payables, and we want to get control of it, maybe we've suffered a financial risk or a fraudulent activity, who knows? They may talk about it, they may not. But what's driving their need to talk to technology providers? What's the business problem they're trying to fix? And indeed, that extends to accounts receivable as well, which is not a place for traditional treasury management systems. And within bottom line, we're allowing treasurers to become part of the consumer process. What I mean by that is we can be part of the merchant acquirer process. So if you're in fast-moving consumer goods type business and you're B2C, if Kevin comes to buy something and Kevin's using a credit card, can you validate that? Can you check that? Can you make sure it's valid? Can you then work with the merchant acquirer process and get those funds into our bank account? Can you reconcile that the money we expected to receive from that point of sale activity was actually received into our bank account? So can you do the reconciliation for us, please? That would be really helpful. Can you remove the need for cards? Can you actually allow for an electronic journey for that payment? The answer is yes. And can you put that into our own consumer front end in a way that it appears to be our own technology? Like, yes, absolutely. We've all got examples of this through, PayPal and others, but we can,
Stripe
if we
being
can,
another
if we
big one and
Stripe be
there right
another
now.
one, absolutely. And if you want to, this is where it's different with bottom line. We've actually gone into the accounts receivable space, and we've become part of that digital journey of the consumer acquisition. We're part of that direct debit, which is an accounts receivable process. And, to my earlier point, we can validate at the point of onboarding. And if there are failures, then we can manage that process, and we can submit to claim, and we can actually profile, how many days after a failed collection that you should collect, and we can provide analysis and statistics and dashboards around that, which can give the customer insights that may drive changes in process. So I think there's a lot around that, and the reconciliation piece shouldn't be ignored, because if you've got the ability to understand what you're due to collect, understand what you're due to pay, and then the next day you actually say, okay, what went in and out of my bank accounts, and you automate that reconciliation process, that's a massive health check to tell you that yes, the payments you released went therefore the beneficiary gets it, therefore you don't have a risk of inbound calls, complaints, you know, reputational risk, supplier unhappiness, and they may be key suppliers to your own process. So you want to remain on a good profile there. And then around receivables, if they haven't been collected, what do you want to happen? Do you just want them rolled into a receivable for the next day, or do you want some kind of escalation to credit management? Do you want some kind of dunning process to be kicked into place? Do you want to continue to sell to people who are not paying you? You know, so it's that connectivity in finance, which I think is a key driver at this point in time in a business. And if you create that connectivity and you create that automation, then you allow your people to become more analytical and observers, and actually to drive informed decision making, which is truly what we want to be doing, right? We don't want to just be doing mundane repetitive tasks. We want to have a career and develop our career and feel that we're adding value to the business through whichever function we concentrate on a daily basis within finance.
No, I like that. I think it's the classic management phrase that whoever gets measures get managed. So if you actually have visibility of these processes, then you actually start being able to manage them in a much better way. That's at least what we try to do internally as well, is always make sure that if something needs priority, then how are we measuring it and keeping on top of it? And I think that's super interesting. Kevin, thank you so much. I'd like you to, just before we wrap up, take us through what Bottomline does for treasurers. And if treasurers want to find out more about your solutions, where can they check you out?
Yeah. Okay. So, bottomline.com is the URL that you should go to. You know, we're a global company, quite unknown actually. We've got 12,000 corporate customer relationships in the UK alone. 6,500 of those is direct customer relationships, businesses of all sizes, small, medium, large, right down to your local mom and shop corner store or your local golf or tennis club, whatever you happen to be part of. We help with the collections of direct debits. And we do this for large utility players as well. We as a business trying to digitize the world of business payments. Now that's B2B and B2C, to be clear. And we've got the infrastructure globally to make payments in any format, to comply with any country specific payment format type. And again, just to justify that to myself, there'll be people who may have heard of eBix, that's new, but eBix is common in Germany and France, has been for a number of years. But guess what? There's a German variety of eBix and there's a French variety of eBix. So there's some nuances, just the same as there's nuances to people's use of Swift messaging formats. There's a template, there's fields, but not everyone uses them. Some people use them for different purposes. eBix now is starting to get introduced in North America. So there's a couple of things to differentiate here. If you're a North American corporate treasurer, if you can use us as part of your supply chain finance, you can use us for supplier invoice payments, and we have a global infrastructure there. And basically in North America, we're taking checks, printed checks out of the process. So that's the digitization journey in North America, and we can help you with that. In addition, if you're in North America or anywhere else in the world and you have a need to solve a fragmented technology or a fragmented process around collections of funds or the payment of funds, then you can use our global payment hub as the means to securely process those. And also you can use our cash management tool if you're a treasury with a very specific working capital management mandate to do everything I've mentioned today: high volume of data, real time, as we can effectively do that. But everything you would need for your treasury management outside of hedge accounting and complex risk management. We don't play in that space. We're very much working capital focused.
Awesome. Thank you very much for coming on, Kevin.
It's been great chatting to you, and nice to do a little bit of research before this interview, just to bring myself up to speed with the latest chatbot thinking. I'm still relevant, which is the good news.
Appreciate it. Appreciate it, Kevin. Thank you so much.